Hello everyone, welcome to the Hippie Greg podcast. In this third episode, we're going to introduce a new addition to the show. In the intro of each podcast, we'll recite a quote and then briefly discuss what it means and my thoughts on it. After that, I'll have a very interesting guest to introduce to you. For today's quote, we're going to go with my all-time favorite from the movie Fight Club. Back when I was in my early 20s, I remember watching Fight Club. I didn't understand it. I shut it off about halfway through and left it at that. Ended up running into a friend of mine, Jeremiah, and he said, dude, you got to read the book. The movie doesn't make as much sense. There's some underlying plots that you may not understand, but check the book out. It's my favorite. You really need to. I read the book. It completely blew me away. I won't get into all the details why, but I want to strongly encourage all of you to check it out. It'll give you a different perspective on life and really make you think about some things. It completely changed me for the better. One of the quotes that, in a sea of many good quotes in this book that stood out, it was said by Brad Pitt's character, whose name was Tyler Durden. He said that the things that you own end up owning you. Think about that. In our modern society, it's so true. Every payment that we have on our houses, cars, cell phones, and every other necessity or convenience of our life takes away a little bit of our freedom. The latest statistics that I heard was that two-thirds of all Americans have little savings and live paycheck to paycheck. When I first heard this, it was the exact situation that I was in. I decided to sell my house, my car, pretty much everything that I own. It has not been a perfect journey by any means, but the freedom that I felt in starting over, really starting from scratch, felt really amazing. I didn't have all this clutter in my life, and it allowed me to focus in on me and what I wanted to do with my life moving forward, which ended up being to become an entrepreneur. I started a food business and a food cart, and it's since evolved into a couple other things. Without that restart, I would have never done anything that I'm doing now. It made me also appreciate a lot of the simpler things in life. In the process of starting the businesses, I had to take on some debt, but I still think that these wise words were the most important thing that I ever heard. This quote will stick with me for the rest of my life. With that said, today we're in Portland, Oregon, with a guest that really embodies the quote. I was looking for interesting people to interview. My friend Darren introduced me to his friend Jeremy Fama. Jeremy lives a very unconventional lifestyle, and he's exactly the type of guest that I was looking for to interview for the show. When we're growing up, I think there's a sort of groupthink mentality that makes many of our lives look very similar. It's meeting people like Jeremy that show us that life has very much contrast to it, and it gives us a perspective of what it's like living outside the box. Jeremy is homeless, but not in the way that most of us see or judge homelessness. His living arrangements are by choice. After hearing him speak, I hope this conversation broadens your horizons and makes you consider that there are many paths in this life and that finding happiness should be the most important thing, and it can look very different for everyone. With that said, I'd like to welcome Jeremy Fama to the show.
Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate you.
So, first, why don't you give me a little background on yourself?
I was born in D.C. I grew up in Maryland. They're very close together. My parents joke it was the cheaper hospital, so that's where I was born, was D.C. Grew up in the East Coast. I always grew up knowing that something was different and something was almost incorrect about life. At a really young age, I was just always very precocious and asking my parents about life and death and just about like why we do things, normal things, not like, you know, why do we have schools and deeper stuff, but just questioning everything.
As a good kid should, right?
Definitely. Yeah. And I've been reading a lot about conditioning that we are taught when we're younger. I think a lot of growing up, sort of knowing something was different, knowing something was incorrect or didn't feel right, was part of the path that led me to believe that there were different ways to live that sort of served more yourself first and your own sort of inner workings. Because I always had inner workings, and that's, I think, why I asked questions a lot. I had a lot of creativity always. I was always moving. I was always running up to random people and meeting them and being very open. I just saw the world as boxed, I guess. Something was kind of wrong with that.
So you grew up in D.C. Where from there?
I lived on my own for a little bit in Maryland also, outside of my parents' place. I was 25 when I moved to California, to San Luis Obispo on the Central Coast, and drove out there with two of my friends. Two of them wanted to live in Portland, and they already had a place lined up. They had an extra spot in their vehicle, and I didn't really have money or means to move, and it just really worked out, and I really trusted them, and they're good friends of mine. Once again, it was one of those, we were talking earlier about serendipity and just how it lined up, and things really clicked, and I knew that I had to make a move, and I had to make a change in my life. I saw an awesome opportunity, and I took it, and it was a really hard one to do. Within a month, I kind of made the decision to leave everything I knew, which, you know, back home, that's kind of like, it's a very sore subject with people that are stuck in their ways, that are sort of narrow-minded. Like, that's kind of a big deal for a lot of people to sort of actually be like, oh, he actually left.
There's a lot of safety and comfort in the things that we know.
Definitely. No matter where you're from, exactly.
How long were you in California?
I lived there for 3 years. I was there from 2012 to 2015. Found an awesome community there. It was a culture shock beyond belief.
Oh, to go from where you're at to California,
beyond,
I can imagine.
Belief. When I said that and your smile, I got goosebumps going down my shoulders. Sun-drenched California every day. It was amazing. And I met a really great community, worked at a cafe. It's been there for, you know, since 1984. I lived in a co-op with 19 people, and that was really cool. That was an alternative lifestyle as well. We were the weird hippie house in the...
Did you have multiple people per bedroom type of thing?
It actually was one huge old hotel built in 1888. It was wheeled to its current location on logs and by horses, and an addition was put onto it. A lady bought it from the newspaper in 1978 and made it into an intentional community. 19 rooms, so it's 19 people, 4 bathrooms, huge kitchen, backyard, garden. We throw the biggest Halloween party in the Central Coast, up to 500 people. Raise like canned food for the community food drive. People have to come in costume, and it's a huge, huge deal. Big bike house, you know, bike community thing.
How much does something like that cost when you were staying there? Do you remember how much something like that was to live there?
Yeah, it was the cheapest around. Mine was $440.
In California, the cost of living is pretty expensive, so that's probably a steal.
It is, and it also is kind of important to know that I think California as a state is just in a very different scale in general. Their money's kind of on a different plateau than most of the rest of the country. I think D.C. might be comparative just because of the money, and maybe New York. It was cheap, and it was an amazing alternative form of life that I was looking forward to, coming from the typical family thing. And I wasn't definitely looking for what I'm doing now. Back then, I was definitely looking for a change, but all the things back in the day led me to what I'm doing now. Definitely a step-by-step thing.
Okay, tell me some about what you're doing now then in Portland.
I've always been a musician in Maryland too. You know, I grew up on trumpet, choir, and multiple different bands. In California, I pursued that also, and I had a trio called The Pushback, one of my housemates, another friend, and did a solo thing. And so when I moved here, I was kind of dead set on living in my car, not paying rent, pursuing music on the street, street performing, finding gigs if I could, meeting people along the way. I definitely wanted to record albums, you know, until I can't anymore.
And what was the draw towards a desire to do things that way?
The draw was pretty much to not have to feel indebted to a landlord, to have to come up with what I think is too much money to be able to just have a place to sleep and have a roof and have things. And those things for me are very minimal, and just for me, based on what I have decided to do. And so with those narrowed down options, I kind of was shown what I wanted to do. And I knew I wanted to focus on music and art. And I felt my spirit and my energy being consumed by it all the time. And I watch a lot of people I grew up with, a lot of influences of mine. I watch interviews of them and listen to their music, and it does nothing but show me. Very similar to how historians look at art history or how politicians look at history and see how things are done. There's a lineage of it. Same with the storytelling, this oratory, you know?
Yeah, right on, man. Living out of the car, playing music, what's your normal venue that you would play music at? Just on the street corner, or
Yeah, that's definitely the first and most successful. And I found quickly that Portland is definitely the city for it. There's people on the street all the time, even when it's raining. Even when it's slow, the people that are out there for a reason, you know. And there's a lot of open people. There's also a lot of closed off people too. I definitely have found my most effective form of connection with people on a real raw level has been on the street corner, especially in front of certain businesses and certain intersections and certain neighborhoods, and getting to know this whole city really well by foot. I had a bike for a while, but I don't anymore. Use bus, you know, so it's a very accessible place. I tried street performing in California, and it's not the same. Just the city I was in is not the same.
Portland's got some size to it, mm-hmm. and there's people that come and go through here. And I would think that street performers, I know that when I have traveled, that's something that has always been fascinating to me. Like, what's this guy's story? How did he end up here? Man, he's doing pretty good. They got a big pile of cash in that box. Mm-hmm. That's always been a fascinating culture as to what some of the backstory is on some of those things. And I'm sure the scene as far as Portland goes, it sure seems like there is quite a wide variety of people out there. I know that some of the population, that there's some substance abuse problems, and you mm-hmm. can definitely tell that. A level of crazy that you don't normally see very often. Mm-hmm. With Portland, it seems like it's a different genre of people that are living that way, and there's mm-hmm. way more of them here than anywhere else, and you don't really know that person's story. With that said, is there anybody that you've met that you think is interesting that maybe you want to share their story?
Oh yeah. When you were describing, I kept picturing multiple. They just kept coming up. I was in San Luis Obispo. I was struggling on what to do. My mom passed away. I needed some strength and some courage. And I knew, she even said, you know, she knew what I was doing and she believed in me. It was so late and there was no one out. And I was just kind of sitting there feeling down. And I started hearing the saxophone, and this saxophone was in the street, and I knew it was live, and I just was like, there's no street performers out here, you know, like, I'm trying to street perform out here, and there's hardly any, and they just pass through, and this guy is just sitting there wailing on a sax, and I just start crying. It was exactly what I needed, and it really reminded me of D.C., something about the flavor of how he was playing reminded me of the Washington, D.C. Metro. There's players down there that just... they're just different breeds of people.
Different know? Breeds of people. And I think that the music, from my experience, that comes from some of these people, I think there's a growing demand for that type of thing. And even on things like YouTube and platforms like that, I'm finding that I'm seeing more street performers. And I think the music industry in a lot of ways has gotten to be really watered down and very generic. Mm-hmm. And the people that are on the streets doing their thing, living a more unconventional lifestyle, they got some soul to what they're doing. And these days, with the way that the world is, I think that we need a lot more of that.
Mm-hmm. Those are the people that show me. And this person's name is Tony Streets. And I quickly thanked him, and he, you know, smiled, and I just wanted him to keep playing, and he wanted to keep playing. And it was one of those code things.
Bro code.
Like, thanks, but you know, whatever. So anyway, I move up here. And who do I run into on Northwest 23rd?
On the streets?
On the streets.
Tony.
Tony Streets. Tony awesome. Streets from the streets. And he's got a circle around him, and he's jamming. And, you know, it's just, he's kicking it with like two other people, just kicking it, jamming with two other people or something. And then they introduce each other. And who has he introduced himself as? Tony Rose. He's in Portland, right? And I look at him, and I'm like, you son of a bitch. Tony Rose, huh? And I'm like, hey, Tony Streets. He goes, wait a minute. He takes his glasses off. He's tall dude. He goes, San Luis Obispo, man. And I was just like, we were like, oh my gosh, you know, we just hit it off, and you know, and the language, right? And, and it's just, I mean, he's the one that comes to mind, because I always run into him and, hey, you need a few bucks, man? Like, helping each other out. You need some food, man? You know, like, any, you need this corner? Like, you want to play for a while? You know, it's like having this respect for each other, and just out of the kindness of the music. Man, I can go on. Andrew plays accordion. His parents are from a different country, and they're, you know, his ancestors played accordion, and my nonnu played accordion from Sicily. So just finding these connections, you know, it's great.
Something that was interesting when I showed up in Portland, I mean, I live in a fairly rural community. It's predominantly white. not a lot of crime, pretty safe place to live, and 15,000 in Portland's huge. And so I remember when I went walking around downtown at night, not having experienced that for some time. Man, I had been here 5 years ago, and for the first hour or so, I really had to check myself because I was just like, I was feeling super uncomfortable with it. And then I really had to just center in. I'm like, dude, like, this is fine. Like, there's people that are here living and doing their thing. And I would imagine that the crime level and the actual threat is pretty low.
I would say with that, your response definitely is a product of your mindset, which is awesome. It definitely depends on what you experience and who you talk to, I could say, because this city is definitely a city of extremes. Mm-hmm. It's definitely an extreme polarization of that response and a very different response, which I think is really, it's really telling with how you're able to fit in to this city based on the level I've seen it at. When I was first living here, I was living in my car and also working in a cafe. I'm a barista by trade too. I met someone that was cool with me living in my car and she didn't want to claim me on taxes. The cash is great. And I was able to help out my community, of course, too. And so, and also coming from a background where I just sort of see it from a lot of different perspectives, and people on different socioeconomic perspectives see me for that too, which is really cool. And the conversations kind of already started in a lot of ways, and the people I meet, especially the crazies you mentioned, the crazies can see me and they're like, oh, okay, I don't want to mess with that guy.
Well, everybody, they have a vibe that attracts or repels, there basically. And when you get around the crazy, so to say, it seems like kind of everybody's repelled from them. It's interesting to me how some people are left on the streets that are in that state of mind. Nobody either takes them in or they don't get put into a psych institution. How they get along like that, I'm sure that there's some kind of policing of that. Is there something that you're aware of, like a
definitely
that the city does to, I think that with Portland, it's so widespread, the amount of people that are living on the streets or in tents, that it's probably hard to control to a certain extent.
It is. And I would say that it's something that's being targeted in an incorrect way from a system that hasn't worked. Maybe worked in a certain way because the issues haven't been so widespread. Now what I see is a system that sort of just kind of wrangles the periphery of what's going on and just sort of curtails the madness, because that's kind of all they can do. But what I have seen is real direct community support. I've also seen real direct community hatred and theft, distrust, and that kind of thing too. You see all kinds of crazy stuff out there. The point is, I think the society's face of it is changing, and it's still being, there's still a language that we still have to figure out, because there's a lot of people that need to be helped in ways that we're not tailored to help yet. Like a great example is, like, someone will have a psychotic break, someone will get nervous, call the cops, give me a lecture about how I didn't call the cops, and then they'll jump on the bus and they won't be there when the cops come. And the person having a break is already finished having a break by the time the person that called the cops left, because the person that called the cops was the trigger. I knew that because I'm the fly on the wall, and I'm part of the community. And when the cops come by and do their roll through, nothing's happening because that's all they do. And then they do one more roll through just because they're bored, and that's that. And if there was something happening, you know, it's not worth it for them to do anything but book them and let them go. Give them a ride around the block and drop them over there so they're not this block's problem. Because, you know, that's kind of, there's a lot of other extreme situations that have happened.
Like in any big city, really.
Exactly. But what I do see here is, being someone that's not from here and is respectful to the way the city's changed, the city has not been tailored for that, and it, I don't think, was ready for it. And it's been experiencing a lot of different clashes from different cultures in how you should do this or how it should be done. In our country, in our dialogue, I don't think we have really worked that out at all,
right?
And how it should really work. So then you're forced to go to the N-word or the direct community around you, you know. And there's people that don't see quote unquote crazies, and people think I'm crazy, just for the record, and I'm one of them too. On a certain scale, I am. You know, we all are, but on a different scale, right? There's so many different types of ways to go about that lifestyle. we're still figuring out how to see it all, you know, and it's all settling here.
Tell me a little bit about what day-to-day experience in your life is like.
Well, it's waking up in the forest. It's waking up fresh air. Usually the first things on my mind are food, water, shelter, music, very, very basic things, and connection with either myself or my community. I keep a really even balance of people I connect with. Those people also connect with other people, and I don't own a phone. I use the internet at the library, you know. I use it as a tool to sort of, as part of my day, and sometimes I don't, sometimes I do. And I also just feel a really strong connection to just spiritual growth and meeting other people that are getting better at growing themselves and what they want to do. I meet people like that that choose that same mantra, but in a negative light or in a darker evil or mistreatment, which I think is a valuable gift that I have out there, is being sort of a bridge between everything, being able to see a lot of different things.
When you're staying in the woods, is it primarily by yourself, or is there a little tribe of people that you have that you're around a lot, or not so much?
It's just me. It's funny because those are usually the questions that are asked. There's a lot of space out there, and I've met other people that live out there, but I meet them in the city. I first lived out there with a friend of mine who introduced me to his spot, and he was there for 3 years, and he wasn't bothered. Situations changed. There was more people on the trail, and I found another spot after that, and he did something else. He lives somewhere else now, and that's kind of how it goes out there, though. It's similar to the street in that way, but it's not. There's not cops doing sweeps out there. There's not people looking to steal your stuff. So you don't have that element, but you definitely have nervous people that will have their dog off the leash, which is not against the rules or anything, but they go to see their dog and they find a camp and they get nervous and call me in. And what I'm doing is technically not, you know, within the legal framework, but if you're talking to a park ranger and you develop a relationship with him and he can tell you're doing your thing and not really bothering anyone.
I can imagine, like, from their perspective, they're going to run into so many people in so many different places in life, mm-hmm. that 5 or 10 minutes spent talking with you, they're going to be like, well, this dude's got his shit together. Mm-hmm. You're not out there getting hammered and completely out of your mind. Mm-hmm. You can have a coherent conversation. If they ask you what you do, you can tell them. And I think that from the perspective that I would see anyway, that those people are doing their job, there has to be some humanness to the mm-hmm. people. I'm sure that there's a wide range of rangers, that some of them are hard asses and then other ones are pretty human. Does that sound about right?
Well, it's interesting because there's only one active ranger for the area. They switch positions. They switch seasonally. There's one active one, but that person can change. I haven't personally met them on the field. I met one on the bus. My buddy Rambo, who used to live out there, introduced me to the other one, and I met one in a coffee shop when we started talking. It's not like on the street when you're getting woken up from your trash pile, you know. And even when I was sleeping on the street, you know, I met the people that I was sleeping behind a church, you know, I met the guy, and that's what you gotta do. You just gotta be yourself, you know.
I hear this name and I wanna know more about Rambo.
The elusive. Well, his name is Rambo Richardson, and he's part native. He's from North Carolina. Now he lives in his car that he converted into a living cabin. He cut out the inside of his sunroof in his Volvo, and he has a living cabin above his Volvo station wagon.
This is why I asked about this guy.
And he actively disarmed a violent person on the Max with a knife. Quick action, jumped in and like kind of saved this person. Was on the news for it. Rambo Richardson, he has a native headdress. He was actually wearing his native headdress when he was interviewed. This son of a gun. And he's a little brother in arms, that little guy. He's hilarious. Yeah, we don't stay in contact too often. He's doing his own thing now, but we were living sort of like within earshot of each other, you know, so at the very beginning. And then I picked a new spot. Yeah, I've been there ever since. Been doing that for about a year and a half.
Oh, that's cool. I'm glad that I asked about him. That's a good story about the knife thing.
Yeah, it is. And it's you know, it's amazing. I mean, he just like, he studies mixed martial arts too, so that has a lot to do with it. And, you know, of course, that was like a year before the crazy, unfortunate thing on the two killings on the MAC station, you know, that guy had a knife, you know. It goes with the territory of sort of living in a different sort of way. You definitely encounter different situations, you know.
You encounter different situations, I would imagine, and in that, if you're coming from it with the right perspective, especially not like heavy drug or alcohol use, a person that's living this lifestyle probably, would you say that you experience a lot of personal growth living the way that you do?
Well, it's the whole point. It's like, it's what drives me, and it's also what shows me I'm doing the right thing. Yeah.
You wake up and every day is a new day. And the experiences that you have are so far outside the norm. So you would have like, we'll just call them Joe Desk Job. And Joe Desk Job goes to work 5 days a week. He works 50 weeks of the year, to and from work, goes home, eats, watch a little TV, wash, rinse, repeat, does the same thing. 20 years later, now Joe's got a big gut because he doesn't work out, and he's kind of doing the same thing, and he ends up getting depressed. And it's so common that people, they get into some place of comfort, and like a comfortable job, and they just kind of roll with it. Living the lifestyle that you're living, kind of knowing the person that I'm talking about, what would your advice be to them?
I struggle with giving advice about my life and theirs. I would seriously try to give advice more on how I operate.
You can share your life with them as opposed to being like, hey, bro, you should do this. That's kind of where you're coming
precisely,
from.
Precisely. Because when you said that, that's just where my mind went when it comes to advice, because I see advice more within a circle of people that have a context and a relationship. I see that borderline as almost like it could be advice, but it could be misconstrued.
That's a really wise way of looking at things.
Well, I appreciate that. And I seriously want to say that it comes from understanding that there are multiple sides. There's two sides of the fence, but that fence, if you look at string theory, has multiple different layers when you look at it from a different angle. Mm-hmm. So the fence, you know, has like dimensions to it. And so when you have a conversation, there's definitely two sides, but the threads that are connected, we encompass so much, you know. And what Joe Desk Job shows me is so much more than someone that's like, yeah, cool, we know what we're talking about. We can grow and give each other advice, right? Or give each other feedback in a certain way. But I really strive to see that other side, because I think that's what our world needs to do. I think we need to really change.
And be able to see some perspective on the other. The guy working the 9-to-5 and the lifestyle that you live are so far apart, but at the end of the day, everybody's human, and understanding people that are on one far end of the spectrum and the other end of the spectrum, when we can look at that other person and maybe see a little bit of ourselves in them, that leads to more understanding of ourselves and of that person.
And that's the self-growth, and that's also the advice. Because that's the advice that you see within yourself that you don't have to hear from someone else. And I've been doing a lot of reading about the self-validation that we are conditioned to love. We're conditioned to love self-love, which is definitely fine. But there's a limit in which I think the mainstream society has gotten too far with stroking our self-love, so to speak, or over-embellishing the fact that we are America number one, stars and stripes forever. You know, it's a model that has a limit, which I think the other is aware of. Because I eat food before it spoils, you know, not to say everyone doesn't. The time in which foods is just an example I just thought of. That's a really quick one I think of, is like, how long is it lasting? How long is it going to nourish me? You know, and just having things like that dictate my day-to-day as far as, you know, Joe Desk Job has its method, but I definitely do too, you know? Like, and there's the sort of similarity that maybe we can give advice on that sort of thing. But once again, maybe this is sort of a conditioned response, but people that are in that sort of echelon sort of have more of an oppressed mentality, looking down at someone that that isn't as well to do with things like food or shelter. So maybe that's something that's ingrained in me to respond to.
Well, unfortunately, when we see a very opposite version of ourselves, sometimes we get a little bit critical to a certain extent, yeah, because you don't fully understand that side of yourself. What aspirations, like where do you see yourself in 5 years? Do you have any type of plan beyond tomorrow? Or
I do, and the way that it happens is definitely, I do make plans. I make them in this sort of method of nonlinear time. My end goal is to always create, and the things in between have this nonlinear way of hitting me. My creative ideas come to me, but also things in my environment come to me in a way that I'm not able to catalog. I've tried.
Time's not linear anyway.
Right. And I've tried, and it really is draining. And I've really realized that
you're not forcing it, you're going with the flow.
Exactly. With the 5 year thing said, I do have so many things I want to do that can be encompassed in that amount of time, but so many things can change that 5 year plan to a 7 year plan or a 5 day plan, you know, depending on what happens. But I definitely want to create. I want to connect more with people. I've been doing music for a long time, and I've been shown that poetry and art, physical like drawings and stuff, has been communicating things in a different way. So I'm definitely going to do more of that. I definitely want to live here for a little bit longer, but I also want to travel. Born with the rambling bone. Yeah.
So I'm a big quote guy.
Me too.
I want to finish. I kind of figured you would be. So I want to finish this up. Give me your favorite quote, or the quote that describes you best.
The supreme purpose in life is not to make a fortune, nor to pursue pleasure, nor to write your name on history, but to discover this spark of the divine that is written in our hearts.
That's awesome. I
like had that. To memorize that. It just... And as I'm saying it, I could feel energy change here. Now it's here. It's here. It's just so full.
Where's that from?
Her name is... I can't pronounce her name. And it was given... She's from India.
Okay.
I forgot her name. It was given to me in a coffee shop by this sweet lady that saw me drawing. And she was knitting. And she just knew. She just gave it to me. Didn't know me at all. She just looked at me. She said, I saw you over here, and I wanted to give this to you. And that's all she said to me. I didn't meet her or anything. We just kind of saw each other, and that was that. And it was the most meaningful thing.
I think when we really open ourselves up to life and not have everything planned out, really be rigid about things and just kind of let life unfold and be more of a vessel as opposed to a force, and just kind of let things roll, that more of those type of things happen.
A vessel with a force, and you just don't have to use the force as much as you need to.
Right.
As much as we're told. Because it's always going. The force is always, it's an unsaid thing that we have a force in our vessel. Yeah.
Well, this has been fascinating. So glad that I was able to sit down with you. And
you too.
Thank you for the time. And we're signing off, and we'll catch you on the next Hippie Show.
I wanted to do a follow-up on this interview and discuss something that really resonated with me after listening to it a few times and doing some edits on it. It was a question that I posed to myself, and I think that it's very relevant, and I want to ask you the same thing. The last time that you were in a city and you ran across someone who appeared to be homeless, what was your initial reaction? Did you think that you were better than them or possibly feel sorry for them? Sometimes we throw a person a dollar, give them some change, and hope that that made a difference in their life. And there's nothing wrong with doing that. And sometimes that's above and beyond what anybody else would do, and they really appreciate it. There's definitely plenty of people in this situation that would cause these reactions to seem justified. There's a lot of substance abuse and people with mental problems, and they're really having a rough go at it. But on the other hand, there's people like Jeremy. He's well-spoken, smart, very passionate about life. I hope this interview gives everyone some perspective, and hope that it possibly changes the way that you think next time you see someone living on the streets. It's great when we find people and friends that are a lot like us, but I found that there's a great deal of people that we meet that are very different from us, and they give us a different perspective that allows us to grow and understand ourselves a little bit better by putting ourselves in another person's shoes and seeing things from a different angle. I really hope that you enjoyed this interview, and I look forward to your comments and feedback. Thanks for listening, everybody, and have a great day.